Good morning. It is Sunday, June 30th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. KUAF is supported by the City of Eureka Springs, trademarked the Wedding Capital of the South, featuring a variety of wedding venues, caterers, and reception halls for the intimate event to the opulent. Information regarding wedding packages, tips, parties, and luncheons available at eurekasprings.org/weddings.
Ahead on Weekend Ozarks, new outdoor workout equipment is installed, a new art exhibit opens, and a new book is published.
But first, this weekend marks the end of the fiscal year for many organizations. Perhaps coincidentally or not coincidentally, several of the week's news stories for the past 7 days were connected to money. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has this morning's Week in Review.
Nonprofit organizations in Rogers will soon have to pay more money to rent city-owned baseball fields for tournaments. Recently, the city's Parks and Recreation Commission decided to eliminate the price breaks given to nonprofit organizations. Barney Hayes is the city's parks director.
Back several years ago when we only had four softball fields, at that point in time we're hosting like three tournaments a year, we were able to give some financial discounts to nonprofit organizations. Now then, we've moved into a different scenario with six softball fields and 20-plus tournaments during the year. And it's just putting more and more strain and more time on our staff to prep the fields, more expenses for the electricity on the lighting, the paper products. It's just costing us a lot more money now that we have 20-some tournaments and six fields.
Hayes says that the change in fee structure will put park fees for renting fields in Rogers more in line with the policies of the rest of the large cities in Northwest Arkansas.
We were the only city that gave some discount to nonprofit organizations with the proper paperwork from the federal government certifying that they were nonprofit. The bigger cities surrounding us do not give that discount.
Though he wouldn't give specific numbers, Hayes says that the nonprofits looking to rent one field for one day would likely pay 2 to 3 times more than they currently pay for field rentals, depending on what services the organization requested with the field rental. Another type of group entirely was on the hook to pay a sizable sum of money this past week. An activist group opposing construction of the Keystone XL pipeline in Oklahoma stopped construction work at a pump station in Seminole, Oklahoma, about 100 miles southwest of Muskogee. 8 members of the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance chained themselves to equipment at the work site, and 3 of those members are from Fayetteville. Eric Whalen is the spokesperson for the group.
We had 4 people who locked their arms using metal pipe through the tread of a earth excavator in order to prevent that piece of equipment from being used. We had 2 other people lock themselves to each other on top of a storage facility for equipment so that equipment couldn't be used. And then we had 2 other people who locked themselves to each other in front of a trailer, a work trailer, so that they could prevent work from beginning that day.
Volunteer firefighters and police reportedly responded and began to use the jaws of life to extricate the activists from the scene. But in the process, one of the activists sustained injury. At that point, the remaining protesters unlocked themselves out of concern for their own safety, which is something that Whalen says members of the group must keep in mind when taking protest actions.
When we go into these actions, there is an understanding that the police could use some pain compliance in order to remove you from the site. But I believe this was the first action where we had like overt threats from the police about how they are not just, you know, we might cause you harm in this process, but telling us we're going to cause you harm.
All told, 10 activists from Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and California were arrested, and bond was set at $1,500 for 9 of them, while bond was set at $1,000 for the protester who acted as liaison with police. Total cost of the bond was about $13,500. Whalen says that the group has more resistance actions planned for later in the summer to block construction of other tar sands pipelines in Oklahoma. And frequent visitors to Fayetteville's downtown entertainment district may soon pay more to park. That is, if they park without paying to do so on the U of A's West Annex parking lot. When the city council meets this week, it is expected to approve an ordinance adding the parking lot to the paid parking plan. Sharon Waters, the city's director of parking enforcement and telecommunications, says that the lot has actually been a paid parking lot for years.
The university had put in paid parking. Obviously, they've got maintenance costs for that lot. And the more it's used, then the more maintenance they have to perform on it. you know, they've been good stewards to allow the public to park there. But in order to kind of recoup some of their maintenance costs, I believe it was about 5 years ago, they changed it to a paid lot. Their staff doesn't monitor into the night as long as ours does. And so gradually people have learned that they don't monitor it late at night, and so people have stopped paying.
With increased use comes increased maintenance costs, and Waters says that the move to have the city lease the lot from the U of A will help unify enforcement among the different parking areas in the entertainment district. Waters says that the revenue generated from paid parking on the West Annex lot won't create additional profit for the city, but rather will help offset operational expenses for the paid parking program. She says that the arrangement is similar to other leases that the city holds for private lots in the off-street parking district.
We collect all the money for them, and they get all of the revenue. However, based on the number of spaces that we manage for them, then we allocate the number of spaces proportionately to our budget. So the 63 spaces in the university lot will be divided by the total number of spaces that we utilize, and that will help offset our labor expense, our motor pool, our vehicle charges, our insurance, and that type of thing.
Parking fees and fines for the lot will be the same as for other public parking lots in the entertainment district, and in addition to the kiosks already in place at the lot, users will be able to use any other city-owned kiosks or their smartphones to pay for parking. And the University of Arkansas Fort Smith received a sizable monetary contribution aimed at curbing the nursing shortage in the Fort Smith region. The university announced late last week that the Pendergraft family, longtime philanthropists and supporters of the university, have contributed $1 million to the college's nursing program. Half of that gift will fund two professorships of nursing, which UAFS Chancellor Paul Barron says will allow the college to seek out the best teachers possible to instruct future nurses at the college. Barron says that the other $500,000 will go toward creating a simulation lab space to accommodate the college's growing nursing program.
Actually, we're going to update and equip some space that we've kind of made a makeshift environment for the overflow of Bachelor of Science of Nursing students, and we'll be able to turn that into a first-rate, first-class, hands-on teaching lab with high-tech equipment for the students.
According to UAFS, more than 700 students are in the pipeline for the degree program. Barron says that the college's bachelor's program in nursing has steadily grown in size.
In fact, we've just recently gone to the University of Arkansas board and asked to end our two-year RN program, our associate degree nursing program, and move entirely into Bachelor of Science of Nursing as far as registered nurses go.
The two professorships to be funded by half of the $1 million gift will be named in honor of Jim Hanna and Doug Smith, former business partners of Neil Pendergraft, and Barron says that both were businessmen who recognized the importance of the college in the Fort Smith community. In the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
The initial results of a new small trial for a vaccine for type 1 diabetes are providing cause for optimism among researchers. The trial, led by researchers at Stanford University, indicates progress in switching off the part of the body's immune system responsible for damaging the cells from the pancreas that produce insulin. This is good news and could lead to better news for the more than 3 million people in the country with type 1 diabetes. Before he was a teenager, Jim Fairbanks of Fayetteville found out he had type 1 diabetes. He's written about that experience and other experiences in the few decades since in his new book, What Didn't Kill Me Made Me Stronger: How I Found Hope While Surviving Diabetes, Vision Loss, and Organ Transplant. Last week, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk about the book, which opens with his seventh grade school year in Fayetteville Public Schools. He writes he was constantly thirsty, and by the middle of the school year, he was putting his entire mouth under the bathroom faucet to quench his thirst. Soon, he was told, when he was 12, that he had type 1 diabetes.
Not right at the beginning of school, but between Thanksgiving and Christmas of that year, somewhere in between there, I started having the classic symptoms of being thirsty all the time and frequent urination and being tired. And I just thought that that was just part of my body changing and becoming an adolescent. And I just thought maybe everyone went through something like that, although I didn't seem to notice other people dealing with it. But I just didn't I didn't know anything about diabetes to know that that was what it was.
Jim says he knew then, right then, that things had changed.
It was tough. I mean, I went through basically a classic depression afterward. I would just go to my room sometimes after dinner and just worry and sometimes cry. But I didn't want anybody to know that and sort of grieved a loss. And I didn't know exactly what I had lost, just knew that what would have been a normal life was what I had lost, and didn't even know. When you're 12, you don't really know exactly what a normal life is going to be for you anyway. And I just knew that some kind of the life that I might have had otherwise was gone.
Jim Fairbanks has lived in Fayetteville, by his count, 7 separate times. As an infant, then for much of his public school life, then he completed his college education here, and then a few more times after that. It was during one of his times away from Fayetteville, right after he had accepted a new job in Austin, Texas, the complications from diabetes began to have a further effect on his adult life. He learned his kidneys were failing, and the health insurance from his new job had yet to kick in. He writes in his book he went into a state of denial and told few friends or family members. But when he learned his vision was going to be compromised as well, he knew it was time to move back to Arkansas.
Sold most of my furniture, quit my job, packed up, and moved back in with my parents. And they were, of course, very supportive. And a few months later, I started going to some National Federation of the Blind meetings and met a few other people who gave me a little bit of encouragement and support. I knew I wasn't in this by myself. But as soon as I could, within a year, and by the summer of 92, my vision had pretty much stabilized to a point. I was legally blind, but not severely. And I wanted to get back here to Fayetteville. I felt like in all of Arkansas, the best opportunities for me were probably here as far as transportation and job opportunities and education and so many other things.
In the book, What Didn't Kill Me Made Me Stronger, Jim Fairbanks recounts his waiting for and receiving a kidney transplant. Then going through the process again. The second time, he received a dual transplant, kidneys and pancreas. When asked about part of the title of his book, the part about becoming stronger, he says,
"Oh, there's so many ways. Just, I feel like because of these things I've been through, when other things come along now, I just don't get as rattled by them. And in so many ways, I feel physically stronger, even though I don't know if that's completely accurate, but I just know that my body has a certain amount of resilience that I didn't think it had before. And going into this, I just didn't know how it would leave me and if I would not have much strength, if I would be encumbered in some way. And I love it when I get the reaction, you don't look like you've had anything wrong with you. Thank you. I work hard at making that look like that. And it's made me just know that I, as my grandmother used to say, I'm a tough old bird. And I can get through things. And I don't intimidate nearly as easily just by situations or people that might try to intimidate me. I wouldn't say exactly cowardly before, but I was more easily intimidated before all these things happened to me, and definitely not the case now. I don't back down from much.
The successful transplant has stymied the disease, and Jim says he wanted to write his memoir to serve as an inspiration for others. Faith, he says, faith in something is vitally important to surviving. He says he had faith that medicine, support, and personal will could help him defeat the disease and help him write the book. He says putting himself back into the 1970s, when, as an adolescent, he first learned he would not have that ordinary life he thought he was destined to have, putting himself back there was tough.
The last few edits, the last few run-throughs of the book were earlier this year, and just going through it, and of course, there was less to change and correct, so that then I went through it even faster, which meant I had to put myself back there about 3 or 4 times earlier this year. And the intensity, I wanted to make sure that the intensity of it all was accurate. And it was sometimes very draining for me. But it was also exhilarating at times, too, because there are moments of great joy in the book as well. And I got to experience that over as well.
He also has a companion website, whatmakesusstronger.com, subtitled The Inspiration Exchange. It's a clearinghouse for news, personal stories, and information for people battling anything from cancer to liver failure to addiction to stroke.
What most of us want is to see how an ordinary person like ourselves got through the same situation that we're in. And it's one thing to be able to identify with a celebrity that has this same problem, but they often have resources that we don't. And just an ordinary average person, how did this person get through it? And it could possibly be a blueprint for your own success story, or you could take certain aspects of that and say, that part would work for me and that part would work for me, this other part, not so much. And at least get some ideas, at least see by example that there is life on the other side of this.
You can read Jim's abridged story at the website or in wonderful detail in his book, What Didn't Kill Me Made Me Stronger, How I Found Hope While Surviving Diabetes, Vision Loss, and Organ Transplant. He'll also be part of a writer's event at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville on Saturday, July 6th.
And what I realized about this story was that it's a story that had to be told, and it had to be told by the person who experienced it and wrote it and, you know, told it in first person. And when I felt like, okay, that makes it clear that this all happened to me because I'm supposed to tell this story.
This is Ozarks at Large.
Exercising outside is not a new phenomenon. Muscle Beach in Santa Monica included city-provided workout equipment as part of the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s. People are often seen along the trails of Northwest Arkansas doing sit-ups on the grass, using benches for push-ups or tricep dips. And Tuesday, members of the Siloam Springs community gathered on a portion of the Dogwood Springs Trail to exercise. Well, sort of. A ribbon cutting was held for the second municipal-owned outdoor gym in Arkansas. The 9 working and moving machines are very similar to what you would see inside most fitness clubs, though the coloring and materials do resemble typical playground equipment. They were installed through the collaboration of 3 unique groups: a nonprofit, Bridges to Wellness, a school, John Brown University, and a municipality, Siloam Springs. Holland Hayden is that city's director of communications.
JBU actually gave the city an easement so that we could install this equipment along the trail.
A member of the Bridges to Wellness board welcomed Tuesday's crowd with a quote from a decades-old Journal of the American Medical Association. He said, "There is no drug in current or future use that holds as much promise for sustained health as a lifetime program of physical exercise." This free outdoor gym along the 1.8-mile trail leaves members of the community little excuse to not exercise. Bridges to Wellness is an organization whose mission is to mobilize community wellness. This gym is one way that they will do that. Emerson Goodwin is that organization's director.
Focus of our work is how can we encourage people to do basically what we know how to do and what we know we need to do. It's just, we don't make it a big enough priority. So we're trying to see, are there ways that we can impact the environment? WellFest, the one-day call to action, is a way that we try to do that. This outdoor gym is another.
He says Bridges to Wellness is a network of community and business leaders and members of the medical community, which, based on the logos represented at Tuesday's ceremony, it's a true statement. The idea of one of their board members, this gym is free and open to the public at all hours. It took a while to come into fruition, but thanks to the collaboration of these 3 entities, it did. Steve Beers is John Brown University's Vice President of Student Development. He represented the school and addressed the crowd.
We live in a great town, don't we? This is a great place to be. Every day there's something else that's going on in our town, whether it's downtown, they're upgrading the area down there, or around campus, around our community. this is another example, I believe, of the way towns get moving forward, and that's collaboration.
Also on hand were parks and recreation workers for the city, as well as Siloam Springs Mayor John Turner. He is also proud of the partnerships involved in this outdoor gym, as well as the ever-expanding trail systems. He says that it all goes back to the quality of life of his city's residents.
When people get off work, they want to be able to go out and get away from the house and just kind of relax and walk. And you see people on the trails almost all hours. From daylight to dusk, I guess I would say that they're here. And we had one a long time ago, had stations throughout this whole trail system here on the John Brown, and it was more of an isometric type thing, and not everybody knows how to do isometrics necessarily. So these apparatus are designed not only for those who are trying to stay in shape or get in shape.
They're for everyone and will work all major muscle groups. The machines have stickers with instructions on them and will even accommodate the handicapped, with certain stations allowing for wheelchair access. Mayor Turner grew up very close to where he stood at this very location. It's next to Sager Creek and close to his heart.
As a kid, I used to play up and down this creek, in the creek, around the creek. We'd fish, we'd camp, we'd go down and throw rocks, and just mess around in the creek and around this property. You know, Siloam still has that feel of a small town where you can just let your kids go and feel safe about it, and I'm proud of that. I'm proud of what we have, but this is it just does bring back fond memories. This used to be a picnic area where every year that had the John Brown family of associates and faculty would get out here, and we'd have a picnic and we'd play softball and games and what have you. And once again, most of the time you'd find the kids in the creek. We're about three or four stages or phases of our Sager Creek beautification, and everything we do along the banks of the creek is just one more thing that we're proud of and can point to when it comes to our creek and what we offer, quality of life that we offer people here when they live in Siloam Springs.
Emerson Goodwin pointed out that while it does look nice, it is in place to be used.
Equipment. It's not going to do anybody any good just sitting here. It does people good when they get on it and start pushing it around.
And people are already using it. Attendees jumped on the workout equipment just after the ribbon cutting, including me.
Oh, I can't do that either.
I know, right?
Oh my gosh.
That's hard.
Oh no.
Oh no. You can do it. You totally did it.
I did one. One.
And you too can use it. Find the outdoor gym at the end of Benton Street, just at the base of the John Brown University campus. This is Ozarks at Large.
Danish composer Carl Nielsen is well known for his six symphonies, but he also wrote other orchestral music, including that for Adam Olenschlager's play Aladdin of 1919. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of the KUAF Sunday Symphony Sunday night from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KUAF. Join me this Sunday for music from Aladdin composed by Carl Nielsen. That's coming up 7 to 9 Sunday night right here on KUAF Public Radio.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. The Angels and Tomboys exhibit opened yesterday at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. It's the last stop for the exhibit before it is broken up and the works of art are returned to their original owners. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended last week's media preview, and she filed this report for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large earlier this week.
Sugar and spice and everything nice. That's what little girls are made of. So goes an old nursery rhyme many of us learn in our youth. Despite what they're made of, girls can have uniquely different personalities. There are quiet, demure, angelic types, as well as some young ladies that are more rough around the edges and who aren't afraid to get as rowdy as their male counterparts. Tomorrow, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville will open a new exhibition titled Angels and Tomboys, Girlhood in 19th Century American Art. According to museum officials, the exhibit explores the various ways artists portrayed young girls, from the sentimental, innocent stereotype to the free-spirited individual. Angels and Tomboys focuses on the period following the Civil War, in which artists began to emphasize the importance of children and particularly young girls as the symbol of hope for a nation damaged and divided by war. It's a bittersweet exhibition for Kevin Murphy, the museum's curator of American art, because it's his last exhibition before he begins a new position in early September at Williams College in Massachusetts. When selecting exhibitions for the museum, Murphy says you have to evaluate them on a number of different levels, such as is it new and informative. Murphy says there were a number of things he found appealing about this particular exhibition. For example, he says it's the first exhibition to really look at this topic in a concerted and focused manner.
It's an important topic. I mean, I think that, you know, we take children and childhood as sort of a natural state, but it's really a constructed state. And it's it has a lot to do with culture and society, and the way we think about children changes over time. And I thought it was really interesting, knowing that, and knowing that I thought that it would also be really appealing to the audiences here, knowing that it's an exhibition that touches on a lot of the themes that Rockwell did, and I knew that Rockwell was on the books, and it's about family, it's about education, it's about community, it's about a number of different kinds of things that I think are universally appealing. I also looked at the range of the artists involved, and I mentioned that, I think earlier, that there are a lot of artists that we have in the collection in the exhibition. So William Merritt Chase, Eastman Johnson, Winslow Homer, Ami Phillips, but there are also artists that we don't have represented in the collection or don't have represented in the collection in the same way. So the great angel image by Abbot Thayer is a spectacular painting that we don't have anything like it in the collection, and those are very rare and they're mostly in public collections, so this was a real opportunity to bring something that to introduce our guests to new artists and then have them kind of experience their old friends in a different way.
Angels and Tomboys is organized by the Newark Museum, and Murphy says this is the last time you can see this collection of art together before the pieces are returned to their permanent homes. The exhibition includes about 72 pieces of art, including paintings, photographs, prints, and sculptures. As is often the case, the space which previously housed the Norman Rockwell exhibit has been redesigned for Angels and Tomboys. Murphy says he would love it if guests are completely disoriented with the space so they can have a new and interesting experience of a place they have been two or three times previously. Helping with that is a new entrance door. Guests will enter this exhibition from what has traditionally just been a side exit door. At the start of the exhibit, museum patrons will be greeted by a striking painting of an angel by Abbot Thayer that's surrounded by a large gold frame. There is no shortage of angels in art, so why was this angel the one chosen for the exhibit?
That's such an iconic painting, and it really, there are a number of the paintings of angels, and there are a number of paintings of angels by him. But that painting, it takes his daughter sort of outside of any kind of reference. So you don't see a landscape in the background. There's nothing else. She fills the frame of the painting, and it's this really. It's so well painted, and it sort of that helps the idea of the sort of poignancy I think that you get of it, and the way that he's depicted her, you do see her both as this otherworldly creature, but there is this sort of poignance about it that scholars have looked at in terms of his and his children's own struggle with their mother's death, and I think you see all of that in the painting. It's also modern in a way that some of the paintings in the exhibition aren't, and some of the other paintings by him are not quite that sort of iconic almost. It certainly looks forward to modernism. Her hands are sort of cut off. She fills the frame in an interesting way. Compositionally, it's almost sort of abstracted. So there were a number of reasons why that one was the one that I think was selected for the exhibition.
The walls have been repainted, and curator Kevin Murphy says he selected the color palette after asking some of the museum's female employees what color their rooms were as children. The walls in the exhibition space feature hues of blue and green and a very specific color of pink that was matched to the color of a ballet pointe shoe.
I'm a big ballet fan, and I had, as part of my office decoration, signed pointe shoes signed by a ballerina named Ashley Bowder, who's with the New York City Ballet, that I had signed. And I just thought that that would be sort of fun. I knew that there was that sort of ballerina image, and there was a lot of pink, and there was a lot of I thought it would be really fun to sort of try to go through our big color, our decks of Benjamin Moore paint, and try to figure out if I could match something. Worked with some staff here, and we figured out a color, and we tried it out, and it looked like it was worked. I thought that it'd be a great way of combining my interest in art history with my interest in ballet in a kind of a subtle way. That would help create a beautiful exhibition, but also be a little bit of an inside thing that for me to sort of know about.
While the exhibition does focus on girls, Murphy says boys should be able to relate to it as well.
That Eastman Johnson of the girl getting dressed in the party dress. I mean, yeah, boys have that experience too. The idea I think it's relatable really to everyone. There are the number of boys in the exhibition, and there are a number of boys both acting as kind of in a way as co-conspirators. There's the great image of the boy and the girl shooting at something. And there's, you know, there's the image of brothers and sisters kind of interacting together. So I think there's a lot for boys too. I mean, to a certain extent, I think boys could, it's like when I was young, I read all my sister's Judy Blume books because you wanted to figure out what was going on. So maybe there's a way in which like that could, I think boys maybe learn something from this. Learn about girls. Come to this exhibition and learn about those mysterious girls.
In an adjacent room, Crystal Bridges is opening another temporary exhibition tomorrow titled Surveying George Washington. The exhibit features an assortment of historical documents on loan from the Harlan R. Crow Library in Dallas, including documents written by Washington or by contemporaries who knew him. The exhibit also features a couple of paintings of Washington, and it aims to provide a look at the former president that offers insight into his life as a real person, not just a historical figure. Crystal Bridges Director of Education and Exhibitions Nikki Stewart says a new touchscreen kiosk will accompany the exhibit, and it will offer guests the opportunity to virtually handle some of the documents included in the exhibition.
So all of the flat documents were scanned, and all of the books were photographed with a camera, and of course our amazing preparator team, they are art handlers by trade, and they know how to handle antique documents without hurting them. So they prepared the actual documents and worked with our creative services team to photograph them at very high resolution. So some of them are in that interactive right now, but the rest of them are part of the archive that we get to keep here. That's part of the reason that I think the Harlan Crow Library was so excited about working with us, because they don't have everything documented or digitized yet. So it felt like a terrific opportunity to get things we both need, digitizing of the documents and all the translation and text, and it was an awesome process, but it was done just a tiny bit by a tiny bit.
Both temporary exhibitions open tomorrow, and they will be on view through September 28th. Admission to Angels and Tomboys is $5 for adults, free for youth 18 years old and younger, and free to museum members. Admission to Surveying George Washington is free to everyone, and no tickets are required. However, space is limited in the exhibition area, and admission is first come, first served, and there may be a waiting period for admittance. More information is available at crystalbridges.org.
The Angels and Tomboys exhibit opened yesterday at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda filed that report for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Good morning. It is Sunday, June 30th, 2013, and sort of joining us now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm not really here. Or I have learned to teleport, because I'm really in New Orleans.
Yes.
But I want to be here with you to talk about another 4th of July tradition. Friday in What's Up, we focused on traditional ways to celebrate. And what could be more traditional than to ride a wooden roller coaster?
Silver Dollar City.
But imagine, amusement parks across the United States in the 20s, there were wooden coasters with names like the Giant Dipper and the Coney Island Cyclone.
Yeah,
and the Thriller.
Cyclone is still there at Coney Island. I mean, I think it's a third generation, but it's still a wooden coaster at Coney Island.
And, a lot of people would tell you, why have a wooden coaster? Because it bounces and it squeaks and it does all those things. But as somebody wrote in a study about these things, they feel dangerous, And that's part of the fun. Well, Outlaw Run at Silver Dollar City, which was new this spring, doesn't do some of those things. It doesn't shake and bump and rattle.
Good.
Because it's got a steel middle somehow.
Well, and it's brand new. It's not as old as that.
Right.
Yeah.
But it does do things that wooden coasters don't do, like a double barrel roll. And it has the world's steepest drop on a wooden coaster, 16 stories at 81 degrees. It's the only wooden coaster to twist upside down three times.
That is practically straight up. Sorry.
And it's the second fastest wooden coaster in the world at 68 miles an hour. Now, I went up for the press day.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. Is any of this designed to make people want to go on this thing? Because all I heard was bullet points of why I would never set foot.
I heard things that I want to go do.
They had people come from all over the world because people love wooden coasters. Like I said, I went to the press day. I took a designated rider.
Yeah, there you go.
They said, you drove all the way here to not ride it? And I said, I'm perfectly happy, thank you. And then I did. There's a POV video on their website. So you can virtually ride the entire thing on this point of view video.
Okay.
That was enough for me.
Yeah.
But they have all sorts of other fun rides for all ages. Like they have the little flying caterpillars for little kids and the Lost River of the Ozarks where you get bathtub wet.
Flooded. Is the flooded mine still there?
Oh, yes. I love
the
flooded
mine.
Fire in the Hole. And Powder Keg, which is, I think, their newest coaster before Outlaw Run. The Giant Barn Swing. They are open all this week, and you should go and have a good time, because what could be more traditional than that? And this afternoon, the First Lady of the Blues.
O.C.
Fisher is performing at 2 o'clock at the Fayetteville Public Library. Now, I'm going to jump up on my soapbox for a second. Mm-hmm. These concerts are free.
Yeah.
These concerts are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
These concerts are currently playing to about 14 people.
Well.
Aww.
Come on, guys. Go see O.C. Fisher this afternoon. Somebody pick my daughter up and take her.
It's air-conditioned, too,
and
if that matters.
And it's fun. It's cool and cool.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to go back to sweating in New Orleans.
Okay.
Thanks, Becca.
Thanks for your virtual visit. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Gellums.
A few notes. Bella Vista Village will offer swim lessons for children ages 9 months to 3 years in the coming month. Lessons will be available from 10 to 11 a.m. July 8th through the 11th at the Met Field Pool. Friday, July 12th will be reserved as a makeup day in case of rain. Lessons will also be available from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. July 9th, 11th, 16th, and 18th at the Kingsdale Pool. For more information or to register, call 855-8170.
You know that through most of the warm weather months in our region, we have First Friday in Bentonville, where there are things going on around the square in downtown. There's First Thursday in Fayetteville that's connected to the Fayetteville Underground and the downtown. Rogers has the, folks in Rogers, I'm sorry, it's the third Friday.
I think so.
And that's connected to sort of an art walk thing. Salem Springs through the summer has Second Saturday Music.
Oh, wow.
Fayetteville Underground has now started, boy, and again, I should have had my note here in front of me, Final Friday, Final Thursday. There are a lot of days in the month, right, that all have something. I say that all to tell you, this time, no First Thursday in Fayetteville because of the 4th of July.
It is 4th of July.
But they do say they will have a First Friday in August.
You could still go walk around the square, though.
Oh, absolutely.
On Friday.
Yeah, yeah.
On Thursday evening.
You don't have to avoid downtown Fayetteville. Right. It's not closed. Just won't have the usual monthly First Thursday.
Right.
Just FYI.
There you go. All right. The Animal Science Department and the Dale Bumpers College of Agricultural, Food, and Life Sciences at the University of Arkansas has formed the first horse judging team in school history.
All right. Antoinette and I mentioned this on the Friday
Daily
Show. Yeah, but and I know nothing about horses other than they have very big teeth.
Okay.
And I stay away from their back legs. They're apparently wonderful animals otherwise. I don't know what horse judging does. Do you?
Well, I mean, if it's at a horse show, I'm sure it's just like a dog show. You probably have to.
Okay.
I don't want to say it's just like a dog show. I don't want to make the horse people mad.
Okay.
But.
No, but it's the similar.
But I'm sure, you know, you're probably
find out.
How tall they are, their coats.
Okay. All right.
I'm sure their teeth come into play, too.
Yes. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, is the old saying. We're going to do a story about this on Ozarks at Large sometime in the future because I want to find out just what you look for and how you judge and how you learn to be a good horse judge.
But the point of the story is that if you want to join the horse judging team and you're a student at the University of Arkansas, you can do that. And you can do that by emailing Casey Orr at Casey Orr, that's with two R's, at uark.edu.
All right. And for the third consecutive year and the fifth time in the past 6 years, the University of Arkansas has finished in the top 25 of the Learfield Sports Directors Cup. That's the ranking that has all of the most successful programs, not just baseball, football,
all of
basketball,
them. Golf,
all of them. Yeah,
tennis.
Anything you participate in. And the Razorbacks finished 21st in the final standings, helped, of course, by strong showings by all of the cross-country and track and field teams, including a national championship by the men's indoor track and field team this year. 21st in the country. There were some other women's golf did very well this year. Men's golf, women's gymnastic was back in the Super Six.
Volleyball?
So. No. I mean, they had a better year than the previous, and I think they're going to really build on that this year. But no, I don't think they finished nationally.
Oh,
ranked.
Okay. Well, maybe next year.
Yes. I think maybe next year indeed for volleyball. Okay. Absolutely.
Right. I kind of need to wash my car this afternoon. It's like seriously filthy.
All right.
I'm going somewhere with this. If I wash my car this afternoon at Razor Wash on Joyce in Fayetteville, if I purchase the triple blade $12 wash, $2 of that will go to the Jones Center Scholarship Fund.
Okay.
So very generous of Razor Wash to donate $2 to the Jones Center.
All right.
So if you use the wash code 2140 at the time of when you buy your car wash, then
is it today only?
No, it's through September 1st.
Oh, okay.
So you have a while.
So, if you get rained on, you can take
it. But Sunday's a good time to
go
spend the afternoon at the car wash.
Yes, it is.
All right.
This Week in This American Life, the truly incredible story of a guy who started a list of hundreds of Iraqis who needed to get out of their country. They were getting death threats. He was their only hope. And he was 26, living in his aunt's basement, had no idea what to do to help them. How he kind of succeeded spectacularly and failed spectacularly both at the same time this week.
This American Life, just ahead at 10 o'clock here on KUAF.
The seven-member band Roscoe Bandana was the featured band during Thursday evening's Gully Park concert series in Fayetteville. Before their Thursday evening performance, the group stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio to play a few songs. This was one of them. It's called Heartbreak Shake.
All right, Heartbreak Shake. Widows you down, he holds your crown. If you wait for his rain, it will come. And I'm here to blame that I stood fast alone. So love is a heart.
The band Roscoe Bandana from Gulfport, Mississippi, playing Heartbreak Shake inside the Carver Center for Public Radio earlier this week. We'll have more from the group on an upcoming edition of Ozarks at Large. They'll be playing in Siloam Springs in a few weeks, just in case you missed the performance Thursday night at Gully Park. They're also going to return to the area for the Mulberry Mountain Harvest Music Festival in October.
Earlier on the show, we heard a story from Antoinette Grajeda about the Angels and Tomboys exhibit that's at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville.
It opened up yesterday.
Yes.
I have yet to see it.
Well, it just opened.
I know. I'm going to see it, but yeah, I've been inspired already. For this week's montage, I decided we would have Angels and Tomboys. Now, you'll hear the Angels in song, and you'll hear the Tomboys in voice. So there are five Angels references, five Tomboy references. See how many you can pick.
So there's a little bit of a hint there.
Yes.
I said, hey, Mr. Cunningham, how's your entailment getting along? Don't you remember me, Mr. Cunningham? I'm Jean Louise Finch. You brought us some hickory nuts one early morning.
Whenever I chance to meet some old friends on the street, they wonder, how does a man get to be this way? I've always got a smiling face, anytime and any place. And every time they ask me why, I just smile and say, you've got to kiss an angel good morning.
Always knew someday you'd come walking back through my door. I never doubted that. Something made it inevitable. So what are you doing here in Nepal?
I need one of the pieces your father collected.
I learned to hate you in the last 10 years.
Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster.
Well, you don't win any popularity contest with me neither.
Good. I see we agree on something.
Yeah, that and I'm wearing last year's jeans.
I apologize for that remark. I admit I sometimes do pay a bit too much attention to fashion.
Me not enough.
He looked down into her brown eyes and said, say a prayer for me. She threw her arms around him, whispered, God will keep us free. They could hear the riders coming. He said, this is my last fight. If they take me back to Texas, they won't take me back alive. There were seven Spanish angels at the altar of the sun.
You know what I don't understand, Chuck? I don't understand love.
Who does?
Explain love to me, Chuck.
I want my $200. I heard you through the door talking to that man. It's my money you got, and I want it.
Now, you just hold on a second.
I want my money. You took my $200.
Will you quiet down here?
I want my $200.
Hold on. Just hold on.
The sun came up. It was another day, and the sun went down. You were blown away. Why'd you let go of your guitar? Why'd you ever let it go, that far drunken angel? Could have held on to that long smooth neck. Let your hand remember every fret, fingers touching each shiny string. But you let go of everything, drunken angel.
If you're interested in identifying any of the angel references or tomboys you didn't recognize, you can go to our website at Ozarks at Large.
Dot com.
Yes. Thank you. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Dutton.
Never heard of Dutton.
I was hoping you would say that. Dutton is in extreme southern Madison County. You've been through Dutton because it's halfway between St. Paul and Pettigrew on Highway 16.
Okay.
It's just on the edge of the Ozark St. Francis National Forest. And to my knowledge, I don't think we've ever saluted Dutton before, so...
Okay.
It's your Sunday, Dutton.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
Go Dutton.
Yes.
You can join us Monday at 1 p.m. for the news and more on the new NPR News Show Here and Now. On the show Monday, NPR's Nina Totenberg discusses the big cases decided by the Supreme Court this session: gay marriage, voting rights, and affirmative action. As we mark the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg, we'll hear William Faulkner's words on how that crucial Civil War battle resonated in the South. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now, beginning Monday at 1 p.m. from NPR.
And I'll mention that is in the slot that was formerly held by Talk of the Nation. The production on Talk of the Nation discontinued by NPR. That show does not exist anymore. Thursday was the last one. Sort of a, not even bittersweet, just a kind of a sad edition of...
It was.
But now some people have asked us about Science Friday. That still exists, and we will still continue to have that every Friday. So it'll be Here and Now, Monday through Thursday. You will hear Science Friday on Fridays.
Yep.
And speaking of the Civil War, because William Faulkner is going to be, his words we'll hear again on Here and Now Monday about Gettysburg, a bit of Civil War on our Monday edition of Ozarks
at
Large.
Yes, indeed. I spoke with author Stuart Towns. He's also, I guess, a historian and communications guy. His book is called Enduring Legacy, The Rhetoric and Ritual of the Lost Cause. And he actually spoke yesterday at the Shiloh Museum for Ozark History. But unfortunately, due to timing, you know, our interview will air tomorrow. But really interesting just about how, you know, how the South's perceptions of the war were
fueled, right?
Yeah.
By these post-war sort of oratory people, public speakers, veterans of the Confederate Army that would go and speak and speak ill of the North. And he, I think, from what you've told me, makes the case that that affected South-North relations far beyond the
Civil
War.
Even now. I mean, we were just talking about, the Supreme Court.
Right.
You know, state rights. Largely about the Civil War.
Your conversation with him on Monday's edition of Ozarks at Large at noon and 7. Also, Jacqueline Froelich's story on the now decision to not pursue a Blue Way recognition for the White River. She'll have the latest on that. And she'll talk to some people in Connecticut who did do that earlier. So that and much more Monday, Ozarks at Large, 7 and noon on KUAF. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Have a great Sunday.
Yes, happy Sunday.